This is an interview conducted on June the 24th between Vice President Charles H. Lauchie and Professor R.B. Eccles of the Department of History for the Purdue University Archives. It is, the interview is given in Professor, in Vice President Lauchie's office in the Purdue Memorial Center. Well, Professor Lauchie, let's get to the first questions. Where were you born? Where did you go to high school? How did you come to Purdue? Would you take us up to that far?
Yes. I was born in western Grant County in Indiana at a small town named Swayze. I graduated from high school there in 1929. I am the son of C.H. Lauchie, which made me a junior during his lifetime, and Rachel Lewis Spears. Parenthetically, my mother, whose middle name is Lewis, was named for a relative who was named for Meriwether Lewis. The famous Lewis and Clark expedition, that I am a descendant a way back in that respect. My father operated a small town drugstore, having graduated from Purdue University in pharmacy in 1904, at a time when the pharmacy program was a two-year curriculum. And he received the Ph.G., graduate in pharmacy. So this, I suppose, was my first exposure to the technical institute concept. This was at a time, of course, when most persons who were licensed in pharmacy received their licenses via the apprenticeship route. I also had an uncle who graduated, considerably older than me, who graduated from Purdue in electrical engineering in 1908. My mother had a very close high school friend who married a Purdue University electrical engineering graduate. There were two or three other people in this small town who had had exposure to Purdue University. My father was an ardent alumnus. I can remember attending my first football game when I was very, very small. I have checked with my mother a number of times and tried to establish the year and my age at that time, and as close as we can come is that I was about 6 years old, but I vividly remember the trip to Lafayette when I first saw my first football game. There was never much talk around our house about you should go to Purdue. In fact, I almost did not go to Purdue because I had two uncles, only slightly older than myself, who went to Wabash College, and I can remember while in high school, I attended graduation ceremonies at Wabash for one of these uncles. And I teetered. I almost went to Wabash. But uncertainty regarding what I wanted to do, as nearly as I can reconstruct it now, led me to select a little larger school, one that, in my judgment, had greater prestige. And my personal thoughts were, well, then when I make up my mind, I can go there from here. And I think this is how I wound up at Purdue. I can recall that the decision wasn't made until after I graduated from high school. It was made during the summer.
Where did you graduate from high school?
Swayze High School. It was a commissioned high school. In fact, it was one of the early commissioned high schools in Indiana. It was commissioned, incidentally, when both my father and mother graduated. This was back 1902, 3, 4, along in there. So this is the way I got to Purdue. I came looking for the most general program that I could get. At that time, we had the School of Science, which later became the School of SEH, Science Education and Humanities. And then, of course, the present School of Science split off of that. But the School of Science in my day was really the Arts and Science College of Purdue University, because it encompassed all of the humanities and that we had and all that sort of thing. I took what in many institutions would have yielded an AB degree. I came out as an undergraduate with something like 54, 55 hours of English literature, of literature. I had a strong sprinkling of history, economics. In high school, my best subjects were mathematics and physics, but I didn't pursue that here. I had the took the usual requirements in the science school, which are pretty minimal, and then went the humanities and social science route. Really, I graduated in the year 1929 and was a part of what I've called the lost class, because nearly everybody in the class of 29 got a job and proceeded to lose it then in the next 3 months or so.
How'd you get into graduate
school? Well, I've got to go back. I still have not focused on any real occupational objective. Midway through my Purdue career, I became bitten with the journalism bug. And I developed a rather intense desire to pursue journalism. I was involved in the Exponent and the Debris and all this sort of thing, and Purdue had three or four writing courses in the journalism field at that time, and I've gone through them all and did well.
Were they taught by our dearly beloved friend Huey McKee?
Two courses I had with Professor McKee. There was a man by the name of Harry Fore on the English faculty at that time, who was an ex-newspaper man. These people both had a considerable impact on me. And I learned a lot about writing from them. I developed a desire to go to the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern. And at one time, I said, at the end of my sophomore year, I shall change institutions. The rude awakening, though, came when I became aware that Northwestern was a private institution. The tuition was completely out of my reach. I was paying something like $36 a semester here at that time, making most of my wage. So when I wasn't able to pursue that, I did not have an occupation objective. In the process of earning my keep, so to speak, turn that off.
Certainly.
Process.
All right, we're back on the tape now.
Yeah, process
okay.
Of earning my living while I was in school. I got a job my senior year at the Mars Theater in Lafayette as a doorman. And it was an hourly job, paid very little, but something. And during the first semester of that senior year, an organization called the Fourth Avenue Amusement Company of Louisville came into Lafayette and leased all of the theaters in the city from the old Luna Amusement Company and proceeded to convert the Mars Theater to sound. Only those who were around during the early days of sound movies can have any real feel for the novelty of this thing and the tremendous crowds that presented themselves for these sorts of things. And when the theater converted to sound, the resident manager made me house superintendent. I was still in school full time. I report to the Mars Theater at 12 o'clock, and I'd be through until 11 at night. I selected the ushers, trained them, and literally ran the floor of the house, and we ran as high as 32 ushers on rush days like Sundays over there. When the end of school was in sight, I still didn't have an occupational objective. I had this journalism bug. I'd always been close to printing. I went to Chicago for a few days. I had many, many employment interviews, but only one offer. I received an offer from the HR, I believe it's HR Donnelly, the Lakeside Press, and I accepted this position at some very nominal salary. I came back to Lafayette, school was out, and the manager of the theater told me that the Fourth Avenue Amusement Company had an opening in Logansport, and it paid more than the Chicago job. It was close to Lafayette, where my girlfriend lived, and we were contemplating marriage. And to make a long story short, I sent Donnelly Company a wire and resigned before I ever showed up. And I took the theater job. I went to Logansport. I became manager of the Luna Theater in Logansport. I was there about 9 months, and I married my college sweetheart, Muriel Grace Knight, and she came to Logansport. We rented an apartment. About another 9 months transpired, and by this time the depression had really moved in. The company closed all but one theater in Logansport, and I was unemployed with a wife of less than a year on my hands. And these were really rough times. We simply packed up and went back to Swayze, where my father still had his business. We moved in with my parents, and I tried to earn my keep by supporting my father as much as I could in the store. He had had to release all help. And things went along from about November to the following summer. And I was desperately struggling for some kind of a foothold someplace, and jobs were simply unavailable. I had not prepared myself to teach, but I had some kind of a feeling that I could get a school teaching job. So I went. This town of Swayze was about 10 or 12 miles from the county seat, Marion, where Marion College is located. And I went to Marion College that summer, attended two summer terms. I went to the bank, I borrowed money. My father became security on the note. And I attended two summer terms, filled in with the required courses, mostly in education, that were necessary in order to obtain a high school teaching license. And I was then certified in English, social studies, and very soon got my first teaching position at Van Buren, Indiana, which is on the eastern side of Grant County. I taught there 3 years. And between the first and second year, I decided I would go to graduate school. Or I decided during the first year that I would go between the first and second year in the summer. I made application to the University of Wisconsin. Was flatly rejected because my undergraduate record simply wasn't good enough. I then made application to the University of Michigan, and they must have had a weaker admission system because they admitted me. And it was not until I started graduate work that I can honestly say that I ever had any true objective with respect to my education. I was something of a dilettante before that time.
What area did you start your graduate work?
Education administration with a minor in journalism and a minor in psychology. Educational psychology.
I'm going to ask you, how did you get into psychology?
That's right. This is
the
way.
This was it.
But I had a tremendous desire, need to move up economically, and so I started out following my first year of teaching, saying I was going to be a school administrator. But you had to take two minors, two cognates as they were called, and I took one of them in journalism and one in psychology. So I continued to teach in the secondary schools. I did some moving around and went over in Huntington County. And by the time I had gotten my master's degree, I was able to get an administrator's license. And I became principal of a consolidated school in Huntington County at a little crossroad town of Liberty Center. And I was principal of the Liberty Center Consolidated Schools for 1 year. I continued to go to the University of Michigan in the summer, but I was able to get a position as a teacher at Bossie High School in Evansville. And people who know the school system as it now exists in the state, I'm sure cannot fully appreciate the fact that we literally had two systems at that time. We had the rural system under the trustee management set up.
Township
schools. And then you had the city schools. And I'll tell you, crossing from one of those was almost like the caste system. Very difficult, because the city positions were much more desirable. They paid more money. You didn't have the interference of the trustee system and all that sort of thing. But I was fortunate. I had assistance from an uncle, who incidentally was the Wabash graduate whose commencement I had attended some time back, who was quite helpful in helping me make contact. And I was employed, and I did go as a teacher at Bossie High School, and I taught high school journalism with one division or one section of American literature. And I was the advisor of the high school paper. It was a good paper. When I went there, it became better. Both years that I served as advisor of this paper, we won all of the national awards on the thing. And I became enamored with this and teamed up with my uncle, Harold Spears, whom I've mentioned before here, who had previously held this same position. And we jointly wrote a high school journalism text. And I might say parenthetically that I participated in two subsequent revisions of that book, and later released my uncle from any obligation to me, and since that time the thing has been revised two more times and is still in print. No longer carries my name. So this was my first serious publication and came out of this high school experience. All this time I had continued to go to the University of Michigan in the summers. I attended, I believe it was three summers after I got my master's degree. And following my master's degree, I started to make this psychology swing.
Now, what year did you get your master's degree?
1935. And having gone beyond a master's degree, I began to get the PhD bug. And I requested and received from the Evansville Board of Education a leave of absence to go to the University of Michigan, where I fully intended to pursue a PhD degree. My wife's parents still lived in Lafayette, and when we were going any place north of Evansville, we always stopped off here. I did stop. En route to Michigan, with not much prospect up there, a faint promise of an assistantship, but nothing certain. And I made the rounds of some of my favorite professors. I can't remember, I may have called on three or four, but one on whom I called. It was Dr. Herbert Creek.
Our beloved chairman of the Department of English.
Right. Who,
excuse me, we'll go off the tape. All right, we're back on the tape now.
I had become about as close, I suppose, to Dr. Creek as a student ever gets to a professor. He was a very gentle man, quiet-spoken man, but a man whom I like very much. I'd had two or three courses with him. And he was one of these people who had a facility of encouraging an individual. So I dropped in to see him, and the conversation was a very low-key one. We simply chatted about this, that, and the other, and we came around, well, what are you doing in Lafayette? Where are you going? Well, I'm on the way to the University of Michigan. Oh, what are you going to do there? And I told him. And he said, have you considered coming back to Purdue? And I said, no. As a matter of fact, it never entered my mind. Well, he said, you know, we have a new man on the campus. President Elliott has employed Dr. F.B. Knight to head the newly created Division of Education and Applied Psychology. And he said, it's just getting going. He said, I've looked this man Knight over, and I think he's going to take this outfit someplace. And if I were a young man, I'd look for something that was on the way up instead of joining a thing that had been in being a long, long time. He said, why don't you give this some consideration? And I said, well, that's a thought. So I marched over to Dr. Knight's office, made his acquaintance, and a long conversation ensued. It came out in the conversation, and I don't remember how it came up, but some reference was made to the Indiana State Highway Commission. And I said, yes, I know Bert Dykus, who is chairman of the State Highway Commission. And he's from my hometown. I know him very, very well. He said, you know Mr. Dykus, the head of the Highway Commission? And I said, yes. He said, you're in the wrong office. He said, the Highway Commission has had created the Joint Highway Research Project. They've given the university $50,000 for research, and they don't know how to spend it. He said, you're in the wrong office. You go down to Mr. Dykus and you get him to earmark $3,000 of that money for research on safety on the highway. Well, I was just naive enough that that's what I did. And I went to see Bert Dykus. And Bert said, well, Dr. Knight is right. He said, we have that money laying up there, and they're just starting to staff it. And he said, they're really having trouble spending that much money. He said, I'll talk to Dean Potter and Dr. Hatt, who was the retired head of the civil school, but was the first director of the Joint Highway Research Project. And to make a long story short, this is what was done. he said, you get yourself a fellowship. And I said, well, how much? Oh, Knight was a very expansive man. He said, get $3,000. That'll be $1,500 for yourself and $1,500 for supplies and expenses. So that's what I did. And I came back, and here I was in business with a $1,500 appointment, which this was when the going rate for graduate students was probably in the order of $25 or $35 or at the very most $40 a month. And
you were, 50, you were well
I was
off.
In Clover. I
you
was
were
in Clover.
Well off in those days, yes, sir.
And so I never got to Michigan. We stopped here. We got a place, rented an apartment down on South Grand Street. Later moved into the varsity apartment. And I spent the summer and the academic year, the following summer here, I went back to Evansville into a new job, which I'll mention in a moment, and completed my PhD in absentia. Now I brought...
At Purdue University.
At Purdue University.
In the year 1940.
1940, that is correct.
All right, how come you were in absentia?
Well, because I had had a call from the superintendent of schools in Evansville who said he knew I was coming back, or he assumed I was coming back in September. And he wanted to talk to me about becoming the first principal of what was to be called Mechanic Arts School in Evansville. This was a trade school. I think we have to go back to the nature of what was then the Division of Education and Applied Psychology, because we did not have a Department of Psychology, we did not have a Department of Education, and we did not have a Department of Sociology. These were all wrapped into this division, and many people taught education and psychology. Herman Remmers was a long-standing example of this. His title was actually Professor of Education and Psychology. So there was a commingling, and we had a very strong group in industrial education at that time, headed by Russ Greenlee. So while I got my degree technically in psychology, industrial psychology, I had a great deal of association with these vocational education people, and became interested in what they were doing. So this business of becoming principal of a trade school was not as much an anomaly as first blush it might seem, because I'd been a high school principal, I'd had this graduate training in education administration. I'd had work in psychology. I developed the interest in industrial psychology with this brush with vocational education, and really, while nobody planned it this way, it really made a good bit of sense. So I went to Evansville. This date we'll have to verify, but I think it was 1939. Back to Evansville. And beginning September 39. Into the new job of principal of Mechanic Arts School.
Now, in the meantime, you were working on a PhD here.
That's right.
Just for the record, what was the title of this thesis?
My thesis was...
We're back on the tape now.
Psychological studies of some factors related to driving speed on the highway.
And that was in connection with your safety project.
The fellowship. I studied the effect of the size, type, and placement of highway signs on the speed of drivers.
Very good.
Applied study.
Yes.
And it was hand in glove with the Joint Highway Research Project. Incidentally, this started a whole series of studies which the Joint Highway Research Project continued long after I left. In fact, they continued this sort of stuff for about 10 years.
Very good.
So, back in Evansville then, I was getting this school going and working at night on lining up my thesis. And I did get it wound up, and I did come back, and I got my degree in 1940, participated in the June commencement, which I believe was the first commencement to be held in the
Elliott
Hall of Music, I believe it was. A few words about this trade school. It was a school, a junior and senior level high school operation. We took young men by transfer from the general high schools of the city. They took a trade curriculum, and their credits were then transferred back to their home high schools. And they received their diplomas, their high school diplomas, not from my school, but from the home school. This was a very rewarding experience to me in a number of ways. First of all, I had an opportunity to associate with some of the finest people I've ever known. Most of these trade school instructors were brought in out of industry because of their trade competence.
Servelle and places like
that's
that.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Osiris Erie can't remember any of the others right now, but they had about a dozen trade instructors. Most of them didn't have bachelor's degrees, two or three did, but they were some of the finest people I've ever known. And we got along just marvelously. I was able to weld that into a fine functioning unit, and it was the pride of the state, and we had many, many visitors from all over the country to come and see what we were doing. Parenthetically, Mechanic Arts School became, or was, then the first wing of what is now Evansville North. Mechanic Arts School is now absorbed into a general high school. As I said, I served as principal of this school for 2 years. At that time, and I came up here between those 2 years and functioned as a kind of assistant to a visiting professor in a summer course. We used to bring in people from other institutions. We brought in a man by the name of Harris, who was a specialist in reading difficulties. I got a summer job up here supporting him, much as a graduate assistant would have done, even though I had a degree. So I maintained that contact. I went back the following year, my second year of mechanic art school. And along about March, I got a call from Dr. F.B. Knight saying that a staff member was going on leave the next year. And would I be interested in standing in for him? I went to my superintendent. I got a year's leave of absence. I came to Purdue the next year as a guest professor. Near the end of that year, the man whom I was replacing got another year's extension, and I got a year's extension. The following year, he got another year's extension, and I sought another year's extension and was told, no, you've had 2 years. You can come back now or cut the cord. Well, in spite of the fact that I had only 1 year inside at Purdue, I cut the cord and I came up here, or stayed here. That meant that I was in guest professor status for each of 3 consecutive years. The following year, this man sought another leave from Purdue, and he was denied, at which time the line became open in the budget, and I was appointed associate professor of psychology.
In applied
still
psychology.
Still in the Division of Education and Applied Psychology.
Yes, I understand.
Now, I think this, Bob, is about time to start talking about the evolution and development of industrial psychology at Purdue, because we're
I would
right
like on, very much to have you do that.
Take we're right on the brink of this now.
And let's go.
So let's go back, detach me from just a moment and set the stage for what I came into.
Incidentally, I tried to get Joe Tiffin to do it. Joe was both elliptical and short.
Yeah.
So anything you can add we'll regard as a development of the history of industrial psychology.
Well, I like to think of what I call the prenatal period of industrial psychology at Purdue, and it all started at the University of Iowa.
That was under Seashore.
Dean
was that
Seashore.
Also in the days of Kelly?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure because I was not intimately associated with this myself, but we got the fallout from it. Dr. Seashore gave great impetus to applied psychology. In contrast to what I will refer to here as the Titchenerian brass instrument type of psychology. You see, the earlier psychologists had been interested in measuring human functions, you see, and but you know, how fast your reaction time is and all of these sorts of things, which really they constituted reasonable and scientific inquiry. But they had very little bearing on anything when you got all through with it.
For example, portals of intelligence among guinea pigs.
Right. And, but Dean Seashore felt, I guess, well, I never knew, I met this man, but I can't say I honestly knew him, apparently felt that really psychology ought to be good for something. And he led the development of applied psychology at the University of Iowa. And, of course, one of the things that we know him for were the famous Seashore musical aptitude tests, in which he developed the phonograph records that made it possible to test such things as pitch discrimination and this sort of thing. Now, Joe Tiffin was a student of Seashore, and Joe had become interested, incidentally, in the psychology of music. Having been a practicing musician, he carried a union card and played the banjo in high school dance bands, and he became interested in the psychology of music. Parenthetically, this led to some interest in speech and speech function and voice, and Joe Tiffin was the first man ever to photograph human vocal cords in operation.
I'm glad you mentioned this, because Joe omitted that from his interview.
At Iowa, there were, as was always the case, late 20s, early 30s, Dean Shishore had surrounded himself with other staff members and graduate students who were interested in applications of psychology at all time. And at the same time, Dr. F.B. Knight, whom I referred to earlier, was at Iowa, and who was, while he was an educational psychologist, served as a research director for people who went far afield from that. I don't know whether it's generally known or not, but Dr. George Gallup of opinion research fame was a student of F.B. Knight's. Donald Laird, who recently died, was a student of F.B. Knight's. So while Knight was an educational psychologist and made most of his reputation in educational psychology and in preparation of textbooks, principally mathematics textbooks for elementary kids, he was still an applied psychologist. F.B. Knight knew Walter Dill Scott, who was an applied psychologist in World War II and responsible for much of the World War I, responsible for much of the mental ability testing. He later became president of Northwestern University. All right, F.B. Knight then was pulled out of this University of Iowa climate, brought here by Dr. Edward C. Elliott, to head this new unit, which Knight participated in helping designate as the Division of Education and Applied Psychology, you see. And the whole emphasis was to be on the application of psychology to human endeavor, including education. Now, Knight was a pragmatist of the highest order, and he came in to the engineering-technical school climate, which was very compatible by virtue of its own pragmatic posture, plus its very close relationship to industry at that time. And this provided about the most fertile field, I think, that one could imagine for the development of industrial psychology. So I call this the genesis of industrial psychology at Purdue, was when F.B. Knight set foot on this campus.
Now, let me just ask, what was the general state of the, let's put it this way, state of the art nationally? Was industrial psychology developing elsewhere?
No, it was not. There were a handful of applied-industrial psychologists. There had only been, in my judgment, one really serious textbook in the field. This was entitled Industrial Psychology by Morris Vitellis. The book at that time was perhaps 15 years old. Vitellis stood out in the country because he was one of the few people who permitted himself to be called an industrial psychologist. There were other psychologists who dabbled. So Tipton said, industrial psychology at Purdue. Well, there were no industrial psychologists to be hired. So as men always do, they start to look over the roster of people they know, and up comes the name of Joe Tipton, who had been at Iowa when Knight left, but because of a departmental blow-up, had left Iowa and gone to the University of Brooklyn for a brief one semester.
I heard about that at Iowa. That is where the professor took the pictures of the girls in the room.
Yeah, and made some sound recordings and whatnot.
Yes.
And Tipton had gone to the University of Brooklyn, where he was busily engaged in recording the speech of Broadway actors, doing analyses, this, he carried this on, analyzing the speech of Hitler and other figures of the time. But Knight reached out and brought Joe Tiffin in. And Joe Tiffin was an applied psychologist, but not an industrial psychologist. But F.B. White Knight waved the wand and said, "Joe, from this point forward, thou art an industrial psychologist, and Purdue University is the hub of industrial psychology. And your job is to prove that I'm not a liar."
In other words, this was a purposeful and policy-making decision
it certainly was.
Make this university famous in an undeveloped area.
Now, remember that at that time, Dr. H.H. Remmers was on the faculty. In fact, Remmers had known Knight at Iowa and may have been his student, I'm not sure of that, but knew Knight and was quite instrumental in helping get him here and then in spotting him in the first place. Now, Remmers was an applied psychologist because at this early age, early point, he was seriously involved in the measurement of attitudes and this sort of thing. And of course, he built his whole professional reputation on that. But he was doing this.
Wasn't he very good at that?
Oh, quite good.
I thought, I knew Herman rather well, but wasn't he outstanding nationally and internationally?
He had an international reputation.
Very good.
But up to the point that Knight came, Remmers was busily engaged in teaching educational psychology potential teachers, and he was doing his attitude research and his measurement stuff out of his hip pocket. And of course, Knight coming in created the climate and made possible freeing up of Remmers to really develop his thing. There were other people added to the staff at the time, but I certainly feel beyond a question of doubt Tiffin was the key appointment. Now, this then I think of as the genesis. Then the real awakening came when Tiffin started to say, "Well, now how do I get started?" And remember that the individual whom I said I replaced here, I purposely didn't mention his name earlier because I wanted to save it till now, was Professor Russell J. Greenlee, who was a professor of vocational education. Had come into the university from industry. And we are now on the brink of World War II, and Professor Greenlee was frantically running around the state conducting all kinds of industrial training programs, mostly for supervision. He had a close affinity with industry. He had a high degree of credibility with industry. He had the ability to open doors. So Joe Tiffin said, "Well, if I'm going to be an industrial psychologist, I suppose the first thing I ought to do is learn a little bit about industry." So he started going around with Greenlee. And the first thing you know, things began to fall in place. Because Greenlee was in there helping identify problems. Tiffin came along with his investigative and research expertise and did the studies. And there are many, many studies that will stand as classics for all time to come. The famous tin plate inspection studies in the Gary Sheeton tin mill, certain studies with assembly personnel, at the Noblet Sparks Company in Columbus, and the thing really began to roll. As the tempo of the pre-war and early war times picked up, people were frantically attempting to employ and train people to do jobs they'd never done before. There was a vast expansion in the workforce. The climate in industry was open in that, you know, anything you can do to help us, you know, we'll let you do, which is a lot different than the climate one would find right this minute, for example, where you got a certain stability and a certain lethargy and so on.
I took part at Ohio University in engineering, science, management, and war training in the problem of labor problems connected with the unions and wartime and the NLRB. I was in on that.
Well, this then, I think I was a period of awakening, and then the real breakthrough came when Tiffin began to assemble in an order, or did assemble in an orderly, organized form, the results of these war plant researches of himself and his students, and into a textbook, Industrial Psychology. And I don't have on the tip of my tongue the date of that first issue.
Well, that is all right. We have it in Tiffin's interview.
But this was the first book in industrial psychology since the publication of Vitelli's book 20 years before. And Vitelli's book still stands as a classic, and always will. But, of course, it didn't have the validity of the updating and all of the current stuff that Tiffin put into his first edition. And having come out with this book, another thing happened, in that USAFI, the Army Correspondence Operation, and I'm trying to remember what USAFI stands for. USAF, but I don't know. Headquartered at the University of Wisconsin. Correspondence Operation. Distributed literally thousands and thousands of Tiffin's book to GIs scattered all over the world who were taking correspondence courses. And this became the greatest graduate student recruiting device that the mind of man could conceive. Because the war ends, the GIs get discharged, the GI Bill is available, and where am I going to go and what am I going to take for a master's degree? You see? And they flooded in to Purdue University, which was a prestigious university, to study under this great man, Joe Tiffin, who was the author of this book.
Now may I just stop you right there, and let's go back a little for a moment into your contribution here, because you were on the faculty from at that time. Now, what were you doing during these war years?
Okay. Remember, the line between vocational education and industrial psychology was a pretty fuzzy one. A part of that time, I was engaged in various and sundry training activities in war plants.
You were serving directly in war plants. They called you down on a problem.
Yes. I was on at that time. Part of my salary was paid from state federal vocational education funds.
Give us an example of a problem.
All right. The Republic Aviation Company, which was headquartered in Farmingdale, Long Island, went down to Evansville, bought several hundred acres of cornfield, and erected a massive airframe plant to produce what was known as the P-47, a fighter plane. They brought a very small cadre of people from Farmingdale and had to take the urban and many rural folk of the Evansville area into this plant and teach them how to make airplanes. There was virtually no sheet metal activity in Evansville. What I'm really saying is there was little expertise in the community in the areas that were needed. Republic leased a garage building in downtown Evansville, a three-story building, because if you will recall, dealers had no cars to sell during the war. So they leased this huge garage building and set up what I would call a vestibule training school. In other words, everybody who was hired to work in the out on the floor in the Republic plant went to the vestibule school, and he learned to rivet, or he learned to drill, or he learned to do this, that, or the other. Well, training program as it was initially set up was poorly conceived, and they were having all kinds of trouble matching the output of the school with the growing and emerging requirements of the plant. At this time, the training director for Republic in Evansville was Dr. John McNamara, who incidentally was one of the early PhDs in industrial psychology here, and I had gotten to know him. And he called me up and he said, "Chuck, I think this is something you can help us with." So, as a specific example then, I sat down with them. We did a complete job analysis of the work requirements in the plant. We did manpower assessments. We then went in to the training school and worked with the instructors and guided them in the development of training programs that were compatible with plant needs. And to make a long story short, what we did was to develop a sequence type of training, a sort of a program whereby whether you had been in the training school 3 days or 2 weeks or 3 months, when you came out, there was a job you could do. In other words, we built the thing up, and this made it unnecessary to predict with any degree of accuracy at all when we were going to need personnel in the plant. In other words, you could not predict that on such and such a date you were going to need 20 of this kind of people in the plant early enough to have put them in at the end of the hopper so that they came out at the right time, you see. So what we did was just keep developing an individual skill in the school. And if we take you out after 3 days, then you can do certain simple things. If there's nothing for you at the end of 3 days, you stay a little bit longer. And now you've got a broader inventory of skills. And this was a very carefully done piece of business. We developed the curricula or course content. And then we took it a step farther and worked with the instructional personnel in improving their basic training techniques. This was one example. And of course there were no two alike, but this is the kind of thing I did. I also, during this period of time, participated in many, many joint studies with Tiffin. I never did count up the number of joint publications that we have, but I suppose it would run up in the 20s, I imagine. We co-authored many selection tests together, you see. So while I take no credit for Tiffin's book or anything, this I was part of the whole stir here. Yes. And but Tiffin's book, being widely distributed throughout the military, brought in many, many high-quality GIs in connection with GI Bill. So that brings us then to the development of industrial psychology here in the post-war years. And we developed a position of prominence in the trade, so to speak, that permitted us to select 3 out of every 10 graduate student applicants. We were one of the early users of tests in the admission of people to graduate school. We used the American Council on Education test and later the graduate record, and we would cream off the top 30% of these applicants. And from that point forward, much of what happened at Purdue can be attributed not so much to the quality of the professorial staff as the quality of the students. In other words, because we had such tremendous selection power, we could take the very top people. They brought the maturity that being through a war would have done, and they were just simply magnificent. I think a couple of specifics here might be in order. In Tiffin's activities, he became associated with the Bausch and Lomb Optical Company. And working with them, developed an industrial vision screening process.
Is this where he learned that nearsightedness was not a handicap?
In some instances, that's
yes.
Right. And this had many, many advantages. First of all, the first forerunner of computers on this campus was in the industrial psychology unit. We had early IBM tabulating, sorting equipment, the very first equipment on this campus, and it was part of the Bausch and Lomb arrangement. Bausch and Lomb paid the rental on this, and it was used for the B&L projects, but available 24 hours, the rest of the 24 hours a day. By that time, Professor Newell Kephart had joined the industrial psychology staff. He'd come in from the Navy, and he was concentrating primarily on vision. And the first machine methods, machine statistics course on the Purdue University campus was taught under a psychology number by Newell Kephart, and incidentally remained that way for a good many years. Another name that has to be mentioned in connection with the vision program is Dr. Edward Wirt, who was a graduate student of Tiffin's, who came in the vision program and was also deeply involved with machine statistics and machine methods at that time. Now, one of the features of the industrial vision program was that when a firm purchased the Bausch and Lomb industrial vision program, one of the requirements was that they must send to a Purdue short course the practitioner who was going to operate this thing. So we had coming to this campus 3, 4, 5 times a year large numbers of industrial personnel. Sometimes they came from the personnel department, sometimes they came from the production department, sometimes they came from the inspection departments. But these were the people who were going to operate the vision screening program back in that came in here for training. This provided a feature in the evolution of the Purdue Industrial Psychology program that I don't think has a counterpart anywhere else, in that it gave the professorial staff the opportunity for reality checks. I mean, here you have in this classroom not a bunch of kids, but a bunch of mature people who've been around, who know what industry is all about. They don't know anything about the stuff we know something about, but they know whether what we're talking about has any practicality. And this continual give and take between these changing groups of people who came into the industrial vision short courses was a very significant factor in the evolution of this program. And here I need to depart to say that Joe and I became so enamored with the success of the Vision Institute that we started a parallel industrial testing institute And this started, as I recall, in 1945. We ran the first two or three here on the campus. And I should say parenthetically that Purdue at that time had no conference division like we have now. It had no mechanism to deal with these oddball groups that came in for a week or two. Didn't fit into the normal semester programming. It was a very difficult thing to shoehorn into the university structure. It was not accepted with great favor by many of the decision makers in the university. And finally, we simply threw in the sponge and said, we just can't fight the bureaucracy anymore. And then the letters started to pour in. When are you going to run the next one? When are you going to run the next one? And it was at that time that Joe Tiffin and I went to our friend, Director F.B. Knight, and said, look, the university isn't very interested in this. How would you feel about our running this as a personal enterprise? Dr. Knight talked with Dr. Elliott, and we were given permission to do that. The ground rules are set up. And this has been going on. Joe and I ran one last November in Chicago, and we will run the next one, and I'm going to, the number 30th, next November, and I'm going to look up the number. I think it may be 33. We'll put that in there. The 33rd consecutive one of these doggone things. We've enrolled something like 1,000 industrial people. But here, too, this provided the same kind of arena in which to test out. I mean, you get some real bright graduate students around you who have a million ideas, many of which aren't practical. But you frame something, you go into the industrial people, they knock some of the corners off, you come back. This kind of reiterative process was tremendously valuable to industry, tremendously valuable to students, and certainly tremendously valuable to the professors involved. Another new dimension to Purdue's industrial psychology development came when an individual by the name of E.J. McCormick showed up as a graduate student. E.J. McCormick was a retired Navy veteran, retired for disability reasons, having acquired polio while he was in the Navy. And so he retired, I think, as a lieutenant commander, I recall. But he had had a distinguished career prior to coming here. He had one of the major hands in the development and publication of the first United States Employment Service Occupational Dictionary. While in the Navy, he had done job analysis work and had later been loaned to General Hershey's Selective Service Office by the Navy to participate in the development of certain job classifications and whatnot. He contracted polio and was later, as I said, retired, and came here as a graduate student, a mature individual. And to make a long story short, after he got his degree, he moved into staff status, and as the record will show, has been one of our most distinguished professors, in my view. McCormick emphasized initially job analysis types of activity, but veered a little farther away from that into the whole area of human factors in engineering design. And I suppose one would clearly have to list him in the top half dozen national and international authorities in this particular area. You have two or three textbooks in the field. Now you can see the Tiffin, the Loschi, the Kephart, the McCormick snowball here, reinforced by this these graduate students of tremendous quality. And the older I get, the more I become convinced that the quality of the graduate student in the graduate study mix is far more important than many, many people believe it is. I mean, you just don't have a great professor. Good graduate students make professors great, in my judgment, if they're the right kind of people. It's this interaction and the stimulation. This industrial psychology development had a tremendous impact on industrial psychology as a profession. The American Psychological Association is organized into a number of interest divisions, and Division 14 is the Industrial Psychology Division, about to change its name to include the word industrial and organizational, I think. Both Joe Tiffin and I have been honored by our colleagues in serving as president of that division. There are other of our students who have had positions as on the board of directors and the offices of the various types. In fact, every time one looks at the nomination slate, even now, you can just bet that there are two or three Purdue-connected people that will show up there. Impact on industry, of course, through these institutes and through the placement of our students has been quite significant. I can think of a few specifics here. There is a vice president for personnel of the Abbott Laboratories that is one of my graduates. The man who for many years headed the corporate level education and training function of the International Harvester Company is a student of mine. The man who heads the corporate personnel testing function for Ford Motor Company is a student of mine. The individual who heads up all of management development for the Boeing Airplane Company out in Seattle is an advisee of mine. The corporate director of training for RCA is a student of mine who incidentally stopped at the master's level. The person who heads up management development for the Bank of America on the West Coast is one of these lads. And then one of my students was dean of the College of Education at the University of Illinois, and incidentally Purdue honored him with an honorary degree this last June. Dr. Rupert N. Evans was one of my students. And then, of course, throughout academia, head of the Department of Psychology at Bowling Green University is one of my students. And, of course, they filtered into the consulting firms. One of our lads was with the Dunlop consulting firm. Two of our students participated in the creation of the firm of Lifson, Wilson, and Ferguson, which is a going outfit in Dallas and Houston. And so the effects of all this are multiplied. To me, some of the happiest days of my life were in working with these very, very superior graduate students. During this interval of time, I served as a thesis advisor for 49 PhDs and for 56 master's theses. Now, some of these were the same people.
Now, when you say, I notice here we were talking about, you say member of psychology faculty. When did you become an associate, full professor?
1947. And let's see, I came in, and let's get this straight now. I came in as a guest professor in 1941 for 3 years. Then I became an associate professor. Then I was promoted to full professor in 47.
Very good. And then I noticed that while you continued to teach, you also got yourself mixed up in graduate school.
Well, yeah, I did.
Ultimately, didn't you?
I became fairly early in my faculty career, I became a member of the Graduate Council. And those terms are 3 years now. At that point in time, they were 4 years in length. And I served a 4-year term on the council under E.C. Young. And we became very close friends. And there was a very high degree of mutual respect. And at the end of my appointed term of 4 years on the Graduate Council, E.C. Young appointed me as Assistant Dean of the Graduate School. And so I served in that capacity and concurrently for another 3 years on the Graduate Council. So I served in all 7 years on the Graduate Council, and I developed a much broader perspective, I think, of the total university through the Graduate Council than you ever get when you're immersed in your own
the work
department.
Of the department, yeah.
And when one thinks about what's happened since I left the Department of Psychology, we have to recognize a very, very key role that E.C. Young played in all this, because I'm just sure that he played a significant part in bringing me to the attention of the president, being the base of my being asked to do some of the things later.
Would you say that E.C. Young, to a great extent, developed a graduate school for a large university here?
No question about it. No question about it. E.C. Young understood how these things come about in a large university. He had his principles, his goals, the directions he wanted to go. But he understood about as well as any man that I have ever known that there is no way that you can impose this will on other people, and that if you are going to achieve any kind of objective, there must be a sincere, deep-rooted involvement of those individuals who are concerned with the enterprise. And he was a past master of this sort of thing. He literally drug people into every facet of the graduate school operation. And this, I think, accounts as much as anything else for the evolution of Purdue's graduate school. Again, another man at the right place at the right time. E.C. Young, had he been in that slot 30 years before, I mean, we weren't ready for graduate work, so you had to have a climate of readiness and all that, but
I've always was impressed when I knew Dean Young. His judgment then was pretty shrewd, and he I always also thought that he was one of the few graduate deans who was not in an ivory tower. Am I right in that?
Well, you're certainly right. And he had a facility for cutting to the heart of matters. my brush with graduate deans at many other institutions has caused me to believe that many, many of them are simply concerned with the mechanics of administration, and that they never really get down to the substance of graduate work. And he really had very little patience with the mechanics of things. He said you can get other people to do that, and he wasn't worried about that sort of thing. But he really got down to the basic substance, in my judgment.
Well, then you see, you were assistant dean until 57, then you became something known as the Dean of University Extension in 58.
Yes. My term in
now
the
tell me school tell law. Me about the what that meant in defining university extension,
well,
and why at this time should they put a dean in?
Purdue had had a division of adult education for a good many years, and this was headed by Dr. George Davis,
who had previous to that been dean of math.
Yes, he had been. He was another man who F.B. Knight brought here, incidentally, from Keokuk, Iowa, as a former school superintendent. Knight brought him in. He served, he ran the placement office, the teacher placement office. He ran the licensing business, teacher licensing. And then, I'm sure F.B. Knight had a hand in this, again, dean of men. And then something called director of student affairs, when we attempted to fuse, I guess, the Dean of Men's office and the Dean of Women's office. And then he became Director of Adult Education. And that was the genesis of our conference operation on this campus. Also, going back to World War II and the ESMWT, Engineering Science
Management and War Training,
Chuck Bees, who
That's
was a
B-E-E-S-E.
Right, was a professor of industrial engineering and been brought in from industry. He spent a period of time in which he doubled running the ESMWT program on this campus and off this campus, and being a professor of industrial engineering. The war ended, and Purdue folded these federally subsidized operations all over the state, every place except Indianapolis, Hammond, Michigan City, and Fort Wayne. And this, of course, was before my involvement in this, but my colleagues tell me that at these locations, the judgment was made that there was a sufficient need for this sort of thing, that it could very likely be self-sustaining on the basis of fees. There was no state money, so they continued operations. And this, of course, these operations then became the genesis of the now regional campuses. Dean Bees had been ill intermittently for the last two or three years of his career. There were times when he was well enough to function, but there were long periods of time when he had to be out. Also, the line of demarcation between what the Division of Technical Institutes, or the Division of Technical Extension was supposed to do, just what Bees handled, what the Division of Adult Education was supposed to do, was a fuzzy one. And there were administrative problems because of overlap and what have you. I was called in to the president's office in June, and the president said, Dean Bees wants to resign. I am convinced that we must marry the Division of Technical Extension and the Division of Adult Education, because it's the only way we're going to solve some of these jurisdictional problems. I am inviting you to become a member of the top administrative staff and to become dean of this combined operation. Well, you have to put this in the context of the fact that I had been in administrative work. I had come back to the university. The university had expressed no interest in me as an administrative person, which I never quite understood, incidentally. And I had become deeply immersed in this industrial psychology bit and had made that my life. And I had extensive consulting contacts and arrangements. And now the president of the university says, will you give all of this up now and become an administrator? And you have to also put it in the context of my intense loyalty to the institution, because up until that time, I had never refused to do anything that I'd ever been asked to do. And I was willing to do this, and I had no doubts but what I could do the job. But I did have some deep-rooted doubts, and they revolved around the question as to whether or not I could really divorce myself from what had been my life blood, you see, up since 1940 here.
From a professional interest.
Yes,
in which you had
at age 50, you see, this is a little bit different than at age 32 or 35 or 38. I mean, here you are 50 years old. And can I really do this? And I hesitated, and, well, the president probed a little bit, and I said essentially this to him. I don't know whether I can make the break or not. I can do the job, but I don't know whether I can make the break. And I can remember he said, well, no, you know, you can still keep one foot in the Department of Psychology. You can teach a seminar, you can still have some graduate students. And I said, Mr. President, I have had far too much exposure to these kinds of arrangements in industry to believe that'll work. I said, I have seen the top engineer upgraded to the job of director of engineering, director of research, or what have you. And if he doesn't realize that he's changing professions, still thinks he's going to keep on being an engineer, I said, he just whistling Dixie. I see all kinds of unfortunate things. I said, the only way to do this, and this is my problem, can I quit being an industrial psychologist and start being a university administrator? And he said, well, I'm leaving town. I'm going to be back on such and such a date. And runs my mind. It was about 2 weeks hence. He said, you think it over and you talk to Mrs. Loshy. And he said, and we made a date. And I was to see him again. 3 days later, Professor Beast died, converting what was going to be some kind of leisurely transition into more or less of a crisis. I don't think Professor Beast's death really impinged on my decision any, but it did speed up the timetable. I talked this over with my wife, and I finally decided that I would do it. And I said, I can do it only one condition, and that is that I cut all ties with the psychology department.
That must have hurt.
I never attended American Psychological Association meeting after that. I never attended a Midwestern Psychological Association meeting after that, in spite of the fact that I'd been chairman of the program committee the year before. I didn't go back into the psychology building for 5 years. I took all of my graduate students who were in process and put them into categories. Here's a young man, he really hasn't selected his problem yet. It'll be no difficulty to him to reassign him. There were some who were started, but whose problems I thought were sufficiently central to the interests of other staff members that I said, McCormick, will you take this, and Tiffin, will you take this, and so on. And there were two or three who were far enough along that I couldn't dump them. So the record will show that I had two or three advisees getting degrees after this transition, but we were just literally running out the string. I learned from E.C. Young that when you move out of a department into a position in the central administration, you don't meddle in departmental affairs, you don't meddle in departmental politics. So I avoided it like the plague.
There was one dean I remember who is not here now who did just that.
And I am sure that this may have been misunderstood by some of my colleagues, but there was no. It was, as far as I was concerned, it was an all or none piece of business. There wasn't any kind of halfway. I completely broke with the department, and that has persisted since then. I've not meddled in any way. I still maintain my membership in the American Psychological Association. I have given papers at 4 international congresses since that time, but I have not been back to the APA, and I really don't consider myself a psychologist anymore. The field, of course, has passed me by. An awful lot happens in 12 years. I have not read the literature. I'd have great difficulty in going back into the seminar room and making any contributions in industrial psychology. I might make contributions in other areas, university administration, this sort of thing. So this is the way I became dean of University Extension.
All right, now when let's move into that then. What were the major problems that you had to decide when you came in, or with which you were faced?
Well, they revolved around the axes of these two operations. And I suppose I'll just have to take them one at a time. Insofar as the Division of Adult Education is concerned, it had been in being, I'm not sure, maybe let's say 6 or 8 years. But it still hadn't gotten through all of the growing pains associated with developing a truly service unit to the total university. The role of this, what later became the conference division, or more accurately, the Division of Conferences and Continuation Services, the role that I perceived for this was purely a support role, purely a facilitating role, not to be a doer of things itself, but an agency to support the various and sundry academic arms of the university who want to do things. Now, this philosophy was not understood by certain people in the Division of Adult Education,
you know,
who were more or less jealous, you know, that the Department of History might get a little credit for something they put on, you see. The the various departments didn't perceive the Division of Adult Education in this role. They looked at the Division of Adult Education as a kind of an interloper. These are our adults we want to serve, you see. What business have you guys got in it, you see?
You know, I taught a course under George Davis experimentally at night, one night a week in Michigan City, with a group of people who wanted to talk about American intellectual history. Now, they wanted to talk. We gathered in the place, we had coffee, and we talked for 3 hours, and it was the best adult class I've ever taught. They didn't continue this sort of thing because they didn't want to go to a classroom, you see. They didn't want to sit around in a classroom and have the professor lecture. They wanted to take part in the discussion. George let me do it, and it was very quite nice. I enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, I suppose the biggest problem then was how do you take a philosophy in which you believe, as I did, and still do, and get this accepted within the organization and throughout the university. My hope was that the various departments on the university would look at this division as an outfit that can really, you know, can really serve us, can really do things for us that we either can't do ourselves or they can do it better than we can do it. Now, in order to get to that point, then you really have to start giving some service. And you really got to be able to put something into the stew that the department itself can't do. So this became a training process. It became a matter of developing procedures, standardized procedures for cutting through the red tape of the university so that we didn't have to have a knockdown and drag out over every one of these things, so that we didn't approach each conference like we had never had a conference before and we're never going to have another one again. We developed all kinds of procedures for smoothing out relationships between the department, for taking over the chore types of jobs and bringing some real expertise into the doing of those chore types of things. And so this was the first big problem, or one of the problems or challenges. The other one, of course, was on the other side of the fence out in the state, where the university had been running extension programs ever since the ESMWT program, and in some instances prior to that. And just saying, in effect, now we have extension centers. What is their future? What should they become? What really is the mission of these? Because up until that time, and this is not in any sense critical of Dean Beese or anyone else in the organization prior to that time, and I think if it were possible for them to participate in this discussion, they would agree with what I'm about to say. Everything that had happened up until that time represented, in effect, a reaction on the part of the university. In other words, the university was reacting to specific needs, specific stimuli, and there was no, shall we say, grand plan. I mean, we were literally a chip in the stream, and the chip would veer that way or this way, but there wasn't any real goal. So I would say the problem in that area was one of definition of goals or objectives, articulating the whole matter of what is the future mission of these then extension operations. Now, our approach on that, you approach this as you would a research project. I mean, I don't think there's any question, but what my experience as a researcher and the kinds of research I have done.
And your experience in teaching in public schools in Indiana, knowing industry.
Had fit hand in glove with this, you see, because what we really had to do was start looking at the state as a whole and saying, what are the higher education needs of the entire state of Indiana? And then making some division here between public and private. I mean, what are the privates going to do and what are the publics going to do? And if the public school of the public higher education is going to serve, how are they going to serve? And then, of course, you take your demographic data, the movement to the cities, and our study of population trends and all this kind of business, projection of number of high school youth who are going to go to college somewhere. You take this mass of data, much of which might seem unrelated when you start, but all of which bears on the problem, in-migration, out-migration. And finally, we arrived at the conclusion that the state of Indiana was just literally going to have a whole lot more public institutions than it had at that point in time. So then it was only a short step that, well, if you're going to have additional public institutions, then some of them are going to be in these population centers where self-supporting things, where there's enough of a population base that self-supporting activities have been able to survive. I mean, this is one of the best criteria of where these things should be. So then you really say, all right, we're going to develop these operations ultimately into full-blown institutions of one character or another. And I suppose that was the first policy decision that was made. Then having made that decision, then you start talking and thinking about timetables. When? And how big are the steps? And where does step one take you and step two take you? And we did outline a plan. We said the first objective is to go beyond this offering of spot extension courses, begin to put it into program context, and we'll say our first level is what we would call a complete general freshman year. In other words, a 1 year of offering that would be useful to a young person
going anywhere,
going almost anywhere. Now there are limitations to this, but I think when we talk about a common freshman year, this is fairly meaningful. We set as the next benchmark the 2 year level. In other words, we said we will offer the first 2 years of most of Purdue's baccalaureate curriculum. We'll do it in a way that he can transfer to the Lafayette campus at the end of 2 years, with hopefully no loss at all, but if a loss, a minimum loss. And paralleling this, we said we're going to take the old Technical Institute program, which was outside the pale of academia here, was not managed by the faculty, did not carry university credit. We brought that in to the faculty structure. We brought it into the credit structure of the university. And we ultimately brought it to the point where we award an associate degree. So we said at this second level, the first 2 years of nearly all of Purdue's baccalaureate programs, and as many of these 2-year associate degree programs as the demand will support. And we said that is the next level of development. And you see, at that level then, you are roughly comparable to most concepts of the junior or community college. Only we were really attached to community colleges. Then we said the next level of development will be limited graduate offerings for employed professionals. Now, employed professionals being defined as primarily as school teachers and engineers, although not exclusively. Part-time graduate work in your own community. Sometimes coupled with summer offerings on the Lafayette campus, sometimes not. But if a teacher in the Lake County area could take one course every semester, come down here for a summer session or two, could get that master's degree a lot more quickly than I did, for example, when I had to do it all summer. And this teacher education part of the thing must be viewed within the frame of reference of the state licensing law that gives an individual a limited license with a bachelor's degree. And if you're going to convert this, you must present a master's degree within 5 years, I believe it is. So a tremendous demand for teacher education here brought this graduate business into let's say the third priority position before baccalaureate degrees. A lot of people don't understand why you would do this. The point is that at the time that we did this, the numerical demand existed for the graduate training in concentrated areas, specific areas, whereas we have great doubts as to whether you really have enough juniors and seniors to make a particular baccalaureate program. Of course, the population was growing all the time, so all you had to do was wait, and that was self-recognized.
Your baccalaureate program will come anyway, then.
The introduction of graduate work then had a great impact on the character of new faculty, because no longer then were we simply recruiting just people who had the competence to teach elementary courses, period. But people who had the competence to teach elementary courses and had some graduate interest and competence, you see. So at that point in time, the quality of faculty and character of faculty began to change. So that when we moved then to the next level of baccalaureate program, we had a substantial number of highly qualified faculty already in the inventory, and it was only the matter of filling in a few gaps and valleys.
I noticed that what you did was move some of our faculty from here to the regional campuses.
We had some transfers. I don't think these have been major numerically. We've also had some move the other way. We've had some move from regional campuses in. My guess is, and I don't think I ever made a study of this, that this would be almost balanced, really. There certainly hasn't been a marked flow either way. Now, paralleling this credit course development that I've been talking about, of course, was the development of a tremendous volume of non-credit activity, mostly occupationally oriented.
Your night courses.
Night courses.
Accounting, bookkeeping.
Mostly in response to specific industrial needs. In fact, at the Calumet campus, we're in something like the 20th year of a program with Inland Steel. It's a non-credit program where we do specific things, technical training for them. Along this, with this program development, of course, you've you've had facilities development. We've had land acquisition problems. We've had the whole matter of funding construction. We've had very little support in the state in construction. Modest support within the last 5 years for operating. But we've been able to staff our administrative posts with people of such tremendous quality that they found ways to get the job done in spite of money or the lack of it. We're talking here in the regional campuses about a 12-year development.
That is 12 years from now, or
no? This when I became associated 12 years ago. The student strength over this 12-year period has moved from just over 4,000 people to 11,000 in credit activity. Of course, there are a tremendous number of part-time people, and when one takes the 11,000 students whom we had last September and converts those to full-time equivalents, you come out with 7,000. So last September, our credit load for all four operations was roughly 7,000 full-time students. In this period of time, our full-time resident faculty has gone from less than 100 to almost 500. In other words, it's fivefold. We still use a tremendous number of part-time lecturers. These are people from industry and from such areas as the social agencies and whatnot, professionals, employed professionals, whom we employ to teach specific courses. Our operating budget has gone from slightly over $1 million to more than $15 million next year.
This includes construction costs?
These are just operating. This does not include construction.
Just operating. You look forward to the time when the Calumet campus can send out a football team that can beat the
Well, I expect it will be a long, long time before they can beat Lafayette, and it may be quite a while before they field a football team, but
it may happen.
The facts are that the Calumet campus soccer team defeated the Lafayette campus soccer team this year, and Calumet has fielded a pretty good basketball team, incidentally.
I think you could count on that in Indiana. Well, let's go off the tape for a moment. Professor Lausche, let me say that we're nearing the end of the tape and we've reached a good stopping point. Now, we will have a tape two at a subsequent interview. This is the end of tape one, recorded on June 24th, 1970.